Well, my guest on the Michael Steele podcast is someone that I've known a long time. She's a Baltimore girl, so you know already she's going to bring it and keep it real. She's an award-winning White House correspondent who's had a very unique advantage as the only Black female reporter covering urban issues from the White House. It's none other than April Ryan. She is an incredible lady. She can be seen on CNN as a political analyst. She's also the Washington, D.C. bureau chief on The Griot. She's been featured in Essence, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, and Elle magazines. And her impact in both journalism and politics is well known, regarded, and has been profound. She's come out with a great new work that we're going to get into called Black Women Will Save the World, in which she presents a kaleidoscope of experiences, trials, and tribulations, and how, despite all of that, Black women continue to move forward, persevere, and make space for young women who are coming behind them, and giving credit to the generation of women who came before them. It is an incredibly fun and thoughtful conversation, and I'm look forward to sharing it with you here on the Michael Steele podcast right after this. Well, folks, like I said, you are in for a real treat in this conversation. Thanks for joining us here at the Michael Steele podcast. And it is such a special pleasure to welcome one of the preeminent Black women in American politics and journalism, April Ryan. It is such a joy, such a treat to see you.
A joy and a treat. I love that.
You survived Thanksgiving, baby girl.
My stomach's hurting, but
yours and mine. I love it. Well, there's a lot that, you know, what I love about conversations with April, folks, is you don't just do the generic kind of top level politics stuff. This sister gets way down deep inside the crevices. And before we get into that, I do want to get into what I described to you before we came on as a love story to Black women. It really is how I read through Black Women Will Save the World, an anthem. This is your latest work. You all remember April from her earlier work, The Presidency in Black and White, which really struck a nerve around Washington. And this one, I think, has struck a different kind of nerve, April, in that it really is an unabashed embrace of Black womanhood, what it means in a 21st century setting, with historical links back, you know, through some of the women that you talk about. Tell us a little bit about where your heart was when it first occurred to you, I want to write this book.
My heart was with my late mother, who never got a chance to see all of this.
Wow.
She passed 15 years ago, and she was like ahead of her time. She was that woman. She was the tree hugger, recycler. I want to make sure the world is better for my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Woman, you know, who happened to be Black. She worked on a college campus, exposed her children to everything. And she never saw the first Black president. She never saw the first Black vice president or the woman of color who identifies as Black as vice president. Nor does she see the Supreme Court justice, but trust and believe she would have been out there supporting the appointments, the election, the rise. And in this moment, I thought of her, but I also thought about those other women who were just like her, who fought for this moment, never imagining this moment. All those other women who kept pouring into our community, pouring into their children, pouring into everyone but themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pause, mark the moment to celebrate them. Because if it weren't for these Black women who carried us all on their backs, be it to the polling booth, be it to the schoolhouse, be it to the church house, be it to the workhouse, we would not be, you, Michael, you and I would not be here today.
True, true.
Because you thought, because your story about your mama is amazing.
Yeah.
And you have a dynamic mama who, look at you and your sister. And it's all because of a Black woman who believed in you, who believed in this country. It's not about your politics. It's not about your party. It's about your personhood.
I love the way you put that, because you set that tone right at the beginning. And one of the first things I highlighted in the book was this quote: after all, Black women make the extraordinary ordinary.
Yep.
We drive change in a society that wasn't built for us in order to make it better for all of us.
That's right.
End quote. That to me, I mean, because a lot of people sit back and they go, well, you know, white mothers are no different than Black mothers. Hispanic mothers are no different than that. And at a certain level, that's very true. They want the best for their grandkids and their kids as well. But when you put in 403 years of the shit we Black women have been through, remember, Black women brought to this country stripped of their kids, stripped of their husbands, stripped of their families, and then oftentimes raising babies impregnated by white slave owners. And
raising other people's babies.
And raising other people's babies.
Wet nursing for the masses white. And see, that's the part, Michael Steele, that people don't understand. You have hit the nail squarely on the head. You know, we marched in 1913 during that woman's suffrage march.
Right.
Delta Sigma Theta sorority founders, AKAs, were marching, but we were at the back of the line marching for voting rights for women. Because of our race. We were in the back of the line. We're not included in the program, but we marched because we wanted a better day. And we took it. We continue to take it. We stuff it down. We even digest it. But we continue in spite of. And let's talk about that slavery thing that Kanye West, like, I don't even want to name him, but the slavery thing that he wants to deny. Let's talk about that, because women, Black women, have been strong since our inception in this nation. Mm-hmm. And you trotted off, you ticked off a couple of things, but let's start here, because I've always said, why do we keep saying that April is strong? Well, my mother was a laid back woman, but she was strong, and her mother was strong, and her mother before her was strong. We keep saying that we come from a long line of strength. Why are we strong? Let's figure out, why are we strong? You know why we're strong? It's because we had no choice but to be strong, or you die. When we first got here, no, even before we got here, Michael, when we were over in West Africa, mm-hmm. and the slave captors were getting us, let me tell you how they figured who we were. And you read this in the book. Mm-hmm. They figured who we were. When I say figured who we were, they figured out if we had had children or not by our breasts, if they were perky, we were going to go take that journey, that long, arduous journey. Only the strong survived. If our breasts sagged, you're spoiled. You've had children, so we don't want you. They wanted strong, perky breasts because they felt that we could bear the free labor. We were going to be birthing machines and workers as well. So let's start there. Then we get on the auction block. We're sold. And then once we're sold to whatever plantation, they allow us to mate or whatever. We are with men, but they take our men from us. Men could not stand for their women or they'd be killed back then.
Right.
And then
right.
they were taken from us. Our men, our covering, as for those of you who are in religion, our covering was taken from us. We had to cover. We had to wear the pants and the skirt in our home by ourselves. So where do we get that strength from? It's from the initial inception of what this country and some in Africa did to us to make us strong.
Yeah, no, it is rooted, as they say, in the genes at this point.
Right.
It is something that is also passed on as part of legacy from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Ours is a matriarchal society because it was forced to be that.
Yeah.
And the women found a way to cobble together family.
Yeah.
Even when that family was broken, separated.
Yes.
And made a way for the country as well as their offspring to flourish. I think about your mom and my mom. My mom, mm-hmm. bless her, still with us at 95. Your mom passed 15 years ago, but their legacies are tied together in that here, their son, their daughter are men and women of accomplishment who've been able to represent in a real way that legacy and to right. show the world we may bend, we may be bowed, but we are not broken.
And we won't break.
And we won't break.
Understand that that is not an option to break. You come from that. And it's so crazy because we can look at each other and say, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. we know the story. You right. know, and you don't have to know the intricacies. Mm-hmm, I know, mm-hmm. but once you come, I understand. I get it. And that's the thing that I'm trying to impress upon the world to celebrate this moment because of what it took to get here. And sacrifices of our mothers and your wife and your sister and myself for the next generation right. to get.
And you break it down. So you go through a number of conversations, starting with the superpower of sisterhood. Talk yeah. to us about that, because that really kind of sets us off on this journey.
Yeah.
And then which in the following chapter is you talk about how not to be erased, walking that tightrope, and our fight, our sacrifice, et cetera. But is that initial understanding and appreciation that as Black women, we have a superpower. You have a superpower. what is that? How does it manifest itself? And how does it set in motion the next 200, 300 years of our progress?
There's so many pieces of the formula for the superpower. Resilience is one. Understanding there's not an out as an option, you know?
Right.
It's how we deal with this. Okay, this is where it is. Okay, let me deal with it and keep thriving and moving, and maybe not even thriving, but surviving and moving, because the out is not an option. But then along the way, there's a thing called sisterhood that you talked about. That sisterhood is the connectivity to keep going. For many of us, we have that sisterhood, and unfortunately, some of us don't. But I'm gonna give you two examples of sisterhood in the book. Lori Lightfoot talks about it.
Right.
And then now she's got a new sister coming for her, Karen Bass.
The yeah.
Black women mayors in this city, San Francisco, Chicago, it was Atlanta with Keisha Lance Bottoms, DC, now LA, and there are a couple others. But these women would get together and help each other out, because all of them pretty much have been in the news. When one would get in trouble, the other one would say, look, this is what I had, the same thing. Let me talk you through it. This is the test that you're going through. I've got a testimony for you, you know, and they needed that. And now there's a new person coming in, Karen Bass, into that sisterhood. Another sisterhood, when we think about the Black Panther Party, and this really blew my mind, and it blows so many people away when I tell them this. The widow of Huey P. Newton, Frederica Newton, is a friend of mine. Frederica Newton told me, she said, you know, 70% of the Black Panther Party were not the picture of what you thought it was, men. 70% consisted of a sisterhood of women,
mm-hmm.
Black women, who wanted a better community. They wanted to have food for their children in the morning before they went to school. Now the government is paying for these food programs around the country. They focused in on issues of sickle cell. They also focused in on free clinics for health care. And look at what the government is doing, free clinics. Women are powerful. When we come together, we strike a blow to make people pay attention. And it's
and everybody benefits from it, don't they?
Everybody
benefits from it.
Everybody. And that's the thing our friend Cornell Belcher said. Cornell Belcher, the head of Brilliant Corners Democratic pollster, he said, when women go to serve, particularly in politics, it's about love for the community and uplift. When our male counterparts, Michael, do it, it's for a lot of times power.
It's ego. Power. No, it's just yeah. Straight up. Men are in the game for power. You know, and it's
you
not,
said it, I didn't. As
well, father, well, no, it's true. Because you know what? We're not concerned necessarily about the soft power, right? That comes from raising a family and pushing, you know, some of the social agendas that keep communities strong and vibrant, you know, education and, you know, which is why I would go out on a limb here and beat me back if I'm wrong, but I will go out on a limb and say a good example of how men and women approach the body politic is that if women were in the majority in the House, the majority in the Senate, the majority of state legislatures, we would not necessarily be suffering through the ravages of gun violence. We wouldn't necessarily be suffering through the ravages of food deserts,
right.
the ravages of undereducated children,
right?
Because that soft power is the space that they've always operated in and tried to move men to say, okay, guys, you need to pay attention here and do this. And men were like, yeah, you know, but right now we're
soft power. I'm gonna say the nurturing, the uplift.
Nurturing, yeah.
Nurturing the sense of community, because there's nothing soft about me. We are
still, that's true. That's fair.
We are nurturers. And we have to be really cognizant of how we characterize people. Because Michael, let me tell you something. Some woman, I had an interview with someone at the beginning of the book. She read the book, a white woman from the Baltimore area. And she says, tell me, why are you angry? Why are you so angry about the adultification of children? And you know where I went. I'm like, first of all, I'm not playing into that stereotype of being the angry black woman.
Right.
I'm like, words matter. I'm like, she's like, why are you so angry?
Well, ask her, like, why aren't you angry?
Right. That's what I'm talking
Why
about.
Why aren't you angry? You should be angry about what's happening to those
exactly.
kids.
But I'm going to be the angry black. Why are you so angry? She in her room, why are you so angry? I was like, don't do
Oh, but
this.
Then but then they do. They do. Those same white women, suburban white women, get angry about CRT. They get angry about transgender children who probably are some members of their family, which won't even go there. So they pick and choose their anger. And the things they
yeah,
want to be angry
right,
about.
Right, right. So
but black women, can we say then that but black women have not been afforded throughout history to pick and choose what to be angry about?
We have not. We have been told. We have been given a deck of cards. You know, I think about what Bishop T.D. Jakes says, you know, while other people are given shovels, we are given a spoon to dig out. And we do it so well. And when we do that, they're like, oh, the heap on more. Because they know we can take it, whereas other communities can't.
Right.
Are viewed as strong. We are viewed as not, the world does not view us as the symbol of beauty. They don't view us as vulnerable. We are human beings and we are considered so strong that we don't hurt when we go to the doctor's office, which is crazy. And I'm sitting up here dealing with that situation right now. I'm like, why are you giving me this crazy stuff, making me sick or sicker? I'm like, come on. We have to advocate not just for the community, but for ourselves and every facet of life. And you tell me I'm not going to celebrate. Look, I'm singing this to the mountaintops. Black women will save the world, have saved the world, are doing it, and will do it. And they're trying. Let me tell you something. So many black women were showing up texting me. Look, this is the line I'm in Georgia. Like you say, they're in line to early vote. You know, what are we? 52% of the black population. We are the pretty much the voting block for the Democratic Party, you know.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. There is no Democratic Party without black women.
Without black women. How about that?
There is none.
And so, look, and the example is Alabama in 2017, right? Roy Moore versus Doug Jones. Black in Selma in the Black Belt. These black women were like, look, we've already had racism. We've seen Bloody Sunday. We saw what happened over that racist named bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge for Bloody Sunday. You're not doing it again. In a town that still looks like it did in 1960s, during the time of the Bloody Sunday March, these people, the mindset, these black women said, they rose up. They rose up.
So in the superpower in that chapter, you talk about a number of black women. You already referenced some of the mayors, and certainly you begin with a quote from the mayor of Chicago, Ms. Lightfoot, that sort of sets again that narrative. What is it about this moment that we've seen? The rather, I'd say, somewhat quiet ascendancy of black female political activism, having moved outside of the shadow of the men. I remember one of the most profound conversations I ever had as lieutenant governor was when, God rest her, Dorothy Height came to my office to visit.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of the cherished photos that I have is sitting, and we actually, what was What's funny that? About that, well, she wanted to meet me. And so she reached out to my office for us to meet, sat down with her. We became, in the short time that we spent together, pretty connected. And so she started sharing some stories, and I'll never forget. And your reference to the Black Panthers made me think of this. She was like, yeah. She said, I always found it interesting that when people talked about the civil rights movement, they always talked about Reverend Abernathy and Dr. King and Jesse Jackson. They talk about all the men, but they never talk about the woman who was in the room who told the men how to do what they were about to do.
Male-dominated world.
And so you have that. That's always been the narrative. That has always been, and profoundly more problematic for black women, as you've already noted, that they are forced back into the shadows. If they do decide to come out and protest, they're at the end of the line. They're not up front. They're not part of the mainstay. Yet and still, you have.
And it was a black woman who told Martin Luther King publicly at the March on Washington, tell him about the dream, because he wouldn't have talked about it.
He wasn't going to talk about it.
If it wasn't for Mahalia Jackson,
right,
who leaned over and said, tell him about the dream, Mark, tell him about the dream.
But the women always seem to understand what the moment requires.
Because the speech that he was giving was not connecting
with the people.
Crowd.
Right.
Until she said, tell him about your dream. And she... We feel the rhythms of moments. We feel the rhythms of our home. We feel the rhythms of the community. It's something innately about, innate in us, that we are able to push forward a dynamic that's missing. And it's just something there. I don't know if it's because of the fact that we've been through so much in spite of. We feel the rhythms of things and know when it's time to march, when it's time to act, when it's time to speak, and when it's time to be quiet.
So walk us through how that superpower plays out in a couple of areas that you write about in the book, starting with the idea because you sort of in that section talking about the state of black women in political leadership. And you start with Shirley Chisholm and you sort of work through that. But where do we find ourselves, and how does this narrative, this superpower, play into women not disappearing? And as you talk about, and then of course, in how to sort of walk that tightrope that's always been there for them to walk.
Yeah, there's such a tightrope because, again, if we push too hard, we're the angry Black woman. But we also, when we're at the table, you have to remember there are people who discredit us just for the sake of being a Black woman, even if we have the pedigree that outshines theirs. Or they take our idea and remold it into something else so that they can own it. But I'm gonna give you this example of the power of Black women. Singularly, we are powerful in the rooms because people don't want to give us the credit. And a lot of times I've heard it so much, Michael, from women. They take my ideas. I said, you know why? Because you're dynamic. And if we shape them, and I said, if you left, they would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
They understand your worth, but they don't want to give you the credit. You're not alone, okay? I'm going to give you a singular person. People think she's a loser. No, she's not. She is one of the winningest people. Stacey Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
She lost that governor's race twice. Why? And she really didn't even want to be considered in that number for vice president for Joe Biden. She didn't want to be in consideration because her heart was set on being the governor of Georgia.
Right.
So she was, you know, some of us have dreams and destiny. She felt that's her destiny. But the first time she lost, it wasn't by that much. But this time she lost for what, 300,000 votes?
Yeah, she lost a lot. Yeah.
Why did she lose a lot? Because they sent a message to her. She was so powerful the first time. They wanted to do it resoundingly so that she would know that they didn't want her. But guess what? They did that because she's a winner. She won. This singular woman, Black woman, turned that red state blue. She did the unthinkable and the unimaginable. So they wanted to make sure that she didn't do it again. They fought so hard, poured so much money, dark money and regular money in, just to make sure she lost. She was that much of a threat.
And the thing about that, though, which is interesting, and again, it speaks to the unspoken political power that Black women have, is her legacy won't be two failed runs for governorship.
Mm-mm.
Her legacy will be the fact that she got the U.S. Senate seat not once, but five times. The four mm-hmm. times that by the time Warnock is done, right?
In that part, thank you.
Plus Ossoff.
Yes.
So she brought a Jew and a Black man to the United yes. States Senate because of the work that she had done on the ground in the state right. of Georgia.
And that part. And I, you know what? I didn't even equate her, and I should have, with Warnock and Ossoff. And right now, even though, that's another thing right now, even though she lost the governorship, the race is still tight. That governor's race was about her. The rest of it is trying to come to grips in Georgia.
Yeah.
It was so close. Now the one of them got beyond 50%. They had to have this runoff. So it was tight. It wasn't about her this time. It was about her for the governorship. But this time, Georgia's trying to come to grips with itself. That's what this is between Warnock and Herschel Walker.
No, they're looking at two divergent futures.
Yes.
And the question for Red Georgia is, do we want to align ourselves with Blue Georgia, right, for a better Georgia, or do we really want to do the tribal my party over country storyline and go with someone who everyone knows is highly unqualified to be in the United States Senate, let alone an elected official? And I think that one of the stark aspects of this, of what Stacey did, was she brought people into the process. She, in some sense,
right,
not to put too fine a point on it, is sort of the Harriet Tubman of voting. right? She yeah. created this roadway, this pathway for voters to sort of find this freedom away from and above the process, even though it was used against her in her first yeah. election in 18.
Yeah. As you are making this very cerebral, I'm going to say that she made the unseen seen, or at least feel like
yeah.
they were living in that. And that's where politics is personal. And that's what, that was the special sauce in her magic. Because so many people, particularly in Georgia, because Georgia is this, and we're just being real straight up honest. Georgia is Atlanta, and then there's Georgia.
Right. That's it. Yeah, there's Atlanta, and then there's Georgia. That's about right.
And yes.
Just like there's Philadelphia, then there's Pennsylvania.
Exactly. 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 I mean, come on. We've seen... can you say Oz? That's all right. Anyway, because that was not in Philadelphia, praise Jesus.
But anyway, amen.
You know,
go to church.
What'd you say?
Yes, I said go to church.
I know, but but what we have to understand is that for this Black woman to basically go, and she told them what she was doing.
Yeah.
They never believed it, and she did it methodically and quietly. She said, like, this is what I'm doing, and she did it. And then it was basically Georgia, the state's repudiation of what she did, why she lost the governorship. And those articles, not the articles, the advertisement was so, I've been to Georgia several times during this book tour before, in the lead up to the midterm. Those commercials were awful. I felt my heart broke for all the Black candidates because they were just attacked, knocking everyone's integrity. But for this Black woman, I said they made her look like she was an animal.
Yeah, but that's always the MO. I mean, that's how we take down the Black political figure.
Exactly.
Is you make them as I learned from Marion Barry many years ago. He said, when they come after you, Michael, they're going to come after you in one of several ways. Either they're going to come after you that you are incompetent when it comes to money. They're going to come after you that you can't control your libido and you're just hypersexually active. Mm-hmm. Or they're going to come at you that says that, you know, basically you're incompetent. You're not capable of the job. It's above you, et cetera. And it is true. You look back and look at you know, how they came after someone like Ron Brown, how they came after Jesse, how they came after Mayor Washington, how they come after Black women. And it goes back to the question I was raising again about this slow, silent progression of Black women now moving into the political space the way they have. It is interesting how at once they hailed Mayor Lightfoot and then immediately turned on her.
Yeah.
Immediately turned on her. It's like for some reason they thought that by bringing in a Black woman as mayor, that killings in Chicago would just miraculously stop because after all, she controls that. it's like, well, you're Black. Why can't you tell black boys to stop shooting each other? And I'm like, what? I mean, and it's like what you said, people coming at you in a way that says, well, you know, why aren't you angry? Why are you so angry? Why do I have to be angry? Why can't I just be concerned like you, white person?
Exactly.
Why do they always look at Black men and women through the prism of...
They want us to feel guilty because there is a problem that they are overlooking. They want us to feel guilty for the problem that they haven't solved. It's like Donald Trump when he talked about Baltimore.
Yes.
In Elijah Cummings. You are the president of the United States. You have the capability to see and fix the issue or work with the city, but yet you want to rats and all that.
Right.
You know, that's what this is.
Which is why Sharpton and I went up and said, no, that's just not, we're not having it. We're just not, you're not going to do that to the people of the city. You're just not going to do that.
Exactly. Baltimore, let me tell you something. There's no other city. Well, there are other cities. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Philly are mirror images. And Detroit used to be like this. You can't walk away from cities that have been part of this nation's history. Can you say Fort McHenry? If you don't know about it, Google it, please.
Right.
And there's a song that you sing about the patriotism of this country that comes straight from Fort McHenry.
That's right.
You say Francis Scott Key. But I want you all to Google that. So anyway, but what I'm saying is that there's no other place in the nation like Baltimore that has the word failure built into the very existence of its people, according to Pastor Bishop Walter Scott Thomas. And for you to be president, you have the pen that can write life and death and the tongue that can speak life and death, and you to mock a city. That doesn't say much about you. And I'm gonna talk about Los Angeles, another city that's in need right now. Karen Best, that woman is priceless. That man put that Black woman is priceless. He put $100 million plus into a campaign to defeat this one Black woman. Superpower. Too strong. That's my
problem. I can't believe this brother spent $100 million of his own money to do that.
That's how much the owner of my company, Byron Allen, bought a house with. New house, whatever, but that's a whole other story. But I told Byron the other day, I said, I want to come and stage your $100 million vacation home. And he never said yes.
Right. But he didn't say no.
What'd you say?
I said, but he didn't say no.
He didn't say no. He didn't say yes. But I want to see what $100 million looks like. But for this man to pour that kind of money into this, to fight against this Black woman, and he lost, she's priceless. That just goes once again to the beauty, the strength, the resilience, the superpower of Black women.
We're having a great conversation with my friend April Ryan, and we've been spending time talking about her latest great work, Black Women Will Save the World, an anthem. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up with a little, we're going to wrap up with a little politics. We're going to tie it all into what we see playing out right now across our great land. We touched on a little bit of Georgia, but there's a whole hell of a lot more mess going on. We'll have more with
Kanye.
April.
We talked about one of them, Kanye.
Right, Kanye Yee. We'll have that conversation with April Ryan right after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Michael Steele Podcast. It is such a treat, and I hope you've been enjoying our conversation with the incomparable April Ryan in her latest book, Black Women Will Save the World, an Anthem. And we were talking about how in so many ways you emphasize the price that Black women pay for being first in a space, for being the smartest or most accomplished in the room, for excelling at just being themselves, and particularly in spaces that were not explicitly built for them, and right. how that has translated over time. When you're looking at the number, and we ended the before going to break talking about Mayor-elect Karen Bass, who I have a lot of high hopes for, but also recognize she's inheriting a system that has been largely built beyond her. Her control. Now she's got to come in like Mayor Lightfoot had to do in Chicago, Mayor Bowser had to do here in Washington. We saw the trouble that the mayor here in Washington had to deal with when the white man tried to create an insurrection and wanted to blame her for the lack of response to his shit. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Because you hit it right. his shit.
Yeah, because she ain't nothing to do it. She actually did try to clean it up, but she's like, y'all got to call me in first. But no one was calling. Trump wasn't calling her, but he wanted to blame her.
He was ill prepared for this job.
Right. So you have these examples out here, April. What is that voice? What is that resonating sound that Black women make as a clarion call for a country, for the country going forward? Will we see more Black women emerging in this space? What does that look like? What does that feel like? And how do you think the country responds? Because I look at the response to Kamala Harris, it reminds me of a conversation I had with the vice president in 2018. I kind of wonder about what that would be like in having known firsthand the setup. Everybody mm-hmm. wants you to do the job, and when you do the job, then they want to take you out of the job.
Okay, I hear you with Kamala Harris, but look to Ketanji Brown Jackson. She's made such news.
That's different. That's an appointed position. She's on the bench, but she's not. I'm with all respect, I think folks would see Kamala as much more as a threat than Ketanji Brown.
Ketanji, let me say this to you. Right now, there's a rollback. Potential rollback on affirmative action. For some parts of this nation, she's a threat because of her voice. Her opinions and her decisions may not move the needle for that 6-3 court today, but let's talk about next 50 years or so, or next 10 years from now or so. People are going to look at what she said, and it could help change or keep a law or a perspective in place. Something she is going to move mountains, if not today, in the future. And she could be like Clarence Thomas, sitting there not saying anything. But right. She's making her point known for historical perspectives on issues that pertain to the underserved in this nation. That is a threat to the conservative party, that Trumpism group, who wants to keep America white male, okay? Who wants to keep America a place where they think it's great, or where it should be great, where we are not in leadership in any space, place, or form. Do you understand?
I do. I get that. And I appreciate that point. I just think, and that's a long ball play, and I'm a long ball player, and I definitely understand.
Yeah, it's the long, she's doing the
long term, but there's a hell of a lot of road.
Short term and long term. Kamala's short term and long term. So we have to look.
Yeah, but that's my point, April. There's a hell of a lot of road politically.
Yeah.
For someone like Vice President Harris to travel. And the question becomes very much like Stacey Abrams. How do you think America comes to terms with this emerging presence of the strong Black woman in American politics? How does that play out in American business? We're quick to quote Black men who are in the billionaire club. But we don't talk about Kathy Hughes.
You got Oprah in the billionaire
club. I was saying, but we don't talk about Kathy Hughes and Oprah the same way, right? Right. So my question, a lot of people, I'd love to, we should, run Oprah for president, make her vice president. I'm like, yeah.
And there was that real conversation about it.
There was real conversation, but that wasn't real. It wasn't going to happen.
But they're talking about Michelle. People are looking.
And Michelle Obama, right.
Yeah, people. There is a segment of society that understands Black women are going to see it for what it is. And we have got that keen skill of being able to see it for what it is and move beyond it, to move the ball forward, get the obstacle out of the way and just go. We see clearly. But the problem is that it's still a male-dominated town. It's still a male-dominated society. And let's really put more on it. It's a white male-dominated town and society. Right. And until women are allowed to get into those spaces to bring others in, it's still going to be a fight. The fight's happening. You got not just Kamala Harris and Ketanji Brown Jackson. You got Karine Jean-Pierre, Shalonda Young. You've got Keisha Lance Bottoms in the White House. You've got Susan Rice. And this is just the White House. This is in Washington. You've got Black women mayors. You've got Black women city council people. You had 500, over 500 Black women running for office in 44 states in this last election. You have Black women who are now speaking and taking ownership of the space. You know, Shirley Chisholm talked about this perpetual folding chair that we kept on our back. She said, if you don't have a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. We're going to always keep that perpetual folding chair for right. others, like we do. But we are now building the table, building the chairs that are firm and permanent and planted and convening the conversation. So it's got to keep moving, evolving. And that's one of the reasons, Michael, why I wrote this book, because we have to keep this moment going. If we don't mark the moment, we lose the ground. And I'm writing the book as I show up as a Black woman in a society that was not thinking of an April Ryan in that White House briefing room, or society right. thinking about you as the former head of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. So here's the deal. As they weren't thinking about us, we are here. We're making space for ourselves and others who look like us to come to these tables. We may not agree, but we are making space for others, because if we are out of the room, if we're absent from the conversation or absent from the table, we have no space in this society. We have no, they don't make space for us or room for us. We have to continue to make room for ourselves to push forward the conversation and the dialogue on issues that pertain to us. You know, we just heard Houston's got a water issue today. Oh my God, we're up in arms, Houston. But we're still dealing with Jacksonville. My God, we're still dealing with Flint.
Right.
Black women are screaming this, you know? Our children are still being shot on the street. Black women are not only screaming about this, they're going to the funerals, going to the city council and talking about all of this, you know, but we're also just trying to make it work in the midst of supply chain and COVID and recessionary times almost, that the president says that we're not in. But, you know, I mean, Black women, when they were trying to fix meals for Thanksgiving, they were finding that there were no whipping cream bottles on the shelves. You know, as the family wants, we are running households, we're rising number as head of household, we're rising in number as the breadwinner. And if we leave in the house and things are not always on the shelves, we are complaining. We're the first one screaming at the city council meeting or in the schoolhouse or in the church house, things are not right. I'm giving us our flowers now because we have made change in so many instances and still doing it and will do it because it's innate to our built in our being.
Right. So in sustaining this superpower and acknowledging the sorrows, if you will, who've gone before and who are continuing to walk, you talk about the next steps, you talk about the future, and you close out the book by noting, it's time to get to work. So here's what you can do to help. Acknowledge Black women, because yes. erasure is real and dangerous. Yes. Stop discounting Black pain and suffering. It's killing yes. us. Mm-hmm. Own your bias and work on it, because none of us are perfect.
And that's a big one. Own it. It's hard.
Support sisterhood, respect mm-hmm. spaces for sisterhood, invest in it. And embrace new models of leadership, respect our children and their childhoods, invest in our political strength. And then finally, let's speak for ourselves. That's your capstone for the next generation of Black women who are going to be following the April Ryans and the Michelle Obamas in moving the country closer to its ideal.
Yeah.
Than its current status.
Moving closer to its ideal, not the founding father's ideal, but the ideal of a better unifying community or country.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes in that list that you just read off that I put in this book towards the end, read the whole book, please, and then make sure you chart that off. But sometimes it's hard to face ourselves, looking in the mirror at who we are and who we have been. Are we really taking into consideration the other person? And when it comes to Black women, we are often pushed back, held down, erased.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Because others have not stood up to say, this isn't right. It's time to stand up. And it's time to work for a better day versus how it's been going, because we are now a nation that is getting ready to see a shift, a flip in the majority population in this nation. And you would rather be on the side of people who want to help and uplift and do better than not be on the side of those people. And I'm speaking of Black women. Black women have taken in everyone and loved up everyone. But the question is, has America done the same to her? No.
She's an award-winning White House correspondent. She is an incredible backbone for a lot of women in journalism, who, white and Black, Hispanic and Asian, who I know, admire, and respect her work. She is April Ryan, the author of the new book, Black Women Will Save the World, an anthem. It has been a particular treat for me as a friend, longtime friend, who has been on the back end of that text from April. Okay, so tell me what you know. Just tell me what you know.
You got some good stuff to tell too.
Oh yeah,
always.
But April, you have again held up a light, not just for women, but for all of us to take a look at and see, and recognize the strength of those around us in our families, in our communities, who have been a quiet force for change, a quiet force of leadership, who are now, as we would like to say, no longer quiet, but emerging in a way that you've got to pay attention. And this book, as I said, is sort of a love story to them. It's an anthem, but it's a love story too, because you, the care and concern you have for the stories you tell and the examples you share with us comes through very strongly. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking time to share it with my crew here at the Michael Steele Podcast. We appreciate it.
Anytime. Yeah, this book is in its second printing, and I'm just so pleased with it. And I just want Black women to finally step up and say, you know, I've done the damn thing. But then not only that, to take time to celebrate themselves, because that's one thing we don't do. And yeah, we don't have time for ourselves. It's been given to everyone but ourselves. It's okay. We can do it.
And we can do it. And you did it. And you've done it well, and continue to do so. That does it for this time together, folks. We want to thank our friend and guest, April Ryan, for taking a moment to be with us. Don't forget to show the love to April on Twitter at April Ryan, correct? If I'm not mistaken, is that?
I think it's Eddie. It's either April Ryan or April D. Ryan. It's one of those things. I don't know. for as long as they allow me to be on Twitter.
Right, as long as we're allowed to tweet.
Oh my goodness, that's a whole nother conference. We need to come back for that. No, it's April D. Ryan
at April D. Ryan.
I still have a blue check right now, so I don't know.
Yes, I have one too, but I ain't paying to keep it. So
I'm not either.
I'm not paying off that man's debt. Ain't nobody telling him to go out and spend $44 billion he didn't have to spend.
I didn't buy his car. I'm not buying his Twitter. I'm done. I'm not.
I refuse to play. I'm sorry. I'm not joining in your reindeer game. Not happening.
No.
So, folks, don't forget to check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele for as long as we're there.
Yes.
And certainly the podcast at Steele_podcast. Do the download thing. You know we love it when you do, because you make me feel all yummy inside. And share the likes and the love, and spread the word. I think we've got a great thing going on here, particularly when we have wonderful guests like April Ryan. Until next time, y'all, be safe, be well, get ready for the holidays. We're counting down to Christmas, baby. Counting down. Take care.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.